Welcome to today's webinar. I'd like to introduce my co-moderator for today's presentation, Dr. Jana Martin. Dr. Martin is the CEO of The Trust, the nation's leading provider of professional liability insurance for psychologists. The Register and The Trust have formed a partnership to deliver clinical and risk management content to psychologists. Today's presentation is titled, Treating the Child of Divorced or Separated Parents. Ethical, legal, and risk management considerations. We are very happy to have with us Dr. Joe Scropo, a forensic psychologist and attorney, and a member of the Trust Risk Management Team. Without further ado, I'm happy to turn it over to my co-presenter, Dr. Jana Martin.
Thank you, Mark Morgan. I'm Jana Martin, CEO of the Trust. I am very excited to introduce our featured speaker. Dr. Joe Scropo is a forensic psychologist and attorney who maintains private practices in both law and clinical forensic psychology. Joe is currently a clinical assistant professor at the Hofstra University School of Medicine. Joe received a BA cum laude from the University of Chicago, an MA and PhD from Adelphi University Institute for Advanced Psychological Studies, and a JD magna cum laude from St. John's University School of Law. Dr. Scropo is also a member, as Morgan said, of our risk management team at the Trust. As many of you know, a significant benefit of being a Trust policyholder is access to free, confidential consultation from our risk management experts. Dr. Scropo is one of our many risk management experts with extensive clinical and legal training who provide guidance to policyholders on issues including requests for records, HIPAA compliance, informed consent, telepsychology, and difficult clinical issues. I know you will enjoy this presentation by Dr. Scropo. Dr. Scropo, I'm turning it over to you.
Thank you, Jana. Thank you, Morgan. Okay, I'm just need to do a couple of business things here. I want to make clear that I have no conflicts of interest in this situation, in this talk, and that the information provided here is not legal advice, although I am an attorney, and it's not a substitute for consulting your own attorney, but rather to provide information to help you deal with this topic area in your practice. Okay, what I hope we can learn at the end of this is that you'll be able to identify legal concepts that govern parental responsibilities and rights, that you'll be able to demonstrate risk management techniques when working with children of separated or divorced parents, and that you can utilize methods to balance the parent's desire to know about the minor's communications with the child's need for confidentiality. Okay, so I hope the information I'm going to present to you will be helpful. In this talk, I will not be focusing on how to clinically conduct outpatient therapy with these children. Instead, my focus will be on the legal, ethical, and risk management issues that this population presents, and what you can do to minimize these risks, both to the therapy and to you as a licensed professional. I'll start with something that you know already. Treating children of divorced or separated parents is difficult and features risks that don't arise in treating children in intact families. Some of the risks are as follows. The parent presenting the child for treatment may be seeking to get the child to help the child needs, but it's also possible that the presenting parent is trying to use the child's therapy to further their own conflict with the other parent. For example, by trying to get you, the therapist, to side with them against the other parent. The presenting parent may also be hoping to use the therapy to get information from the treatment that will advance the presenting parent's particular view of what custody arrangement that parent wants to be in place. Yet a third risk for the treating therapist is that the parent presenting the child for treatment may not disclose their hidden non-therapy related goals for their child's therapy. As a result, you as a therapist may not have your guard up and may find yourself suddenly enmeshed in a massively complex situation that tests the limit of your ability to maintain therapeutic boundaries and to adhere to ethical and regulatory guidelines. In dealing with parents who are in high conflict with each other, the therapist may also be pulled into taking actions that are ultimately unhelpful and that put the therapist into ethically questionable territory. For example, a presenting parent may ask you, could you please write a letter about what a good parent I am? Or could you write a letter about how Sally's father doesn't understand her? When the therapist acts on these requests in an attempt to be helpful, it can cause and result in disastrous consequences for the therapy and also expose the therapist to sanctions from licensing boards for straying from their therapist role and becoming advocates for a particular legal resolution to the parent's conflict. So right away, I'm suggesting that having a degree of skepticism is necessary in approaching the treatment of these children. Hopefully your skepticism will turn out to be unnecessary, and you'll find that you're dealing with two parents whose only concern is helping their child deal with whatever difficulties the child has. But if that turns out not to be the case, your skepticism may help to keep you out of trouble and maximize your therapeutic effectiveness. So, what kind of precautions should you consider in treating these children? The very first consideration is rather obvious. You must identify whether the presenting parent is separated or divorced from the other parent, and also gauge the level of conflict that exists between the parents. So anytime a parent calls or presents their child to you for treatment, you need to ask, where is the other parent? And what is the situation between the two of you? Once you identify that the child's parents are not together, the next question is, who can authorize treatment for this child? There are two possibilities. The child can authorize treatment for him or herself, or a parent can authorize you to treat the child. The history of American law has two schools of thought on this issue. The first line of thought is that parents should be the only ones who can consent to a child's treatment. The second argument is that children are people too, have their own inherent rights, and should be able to consent for themselves if they're mature enough to do so. So we'll do a quick review of the law as it applies to the parent-based versus minor-based right to authorize treatment. There's a strong social and legal tradition that parents are the only proper persons to authorize their child's health care. The Supreme Court case of Parham versus J.R. exemplifies the legal reasoning for this position. The court made these statements on the issue of parental control over their child's health care in that case. Quote, the law's concept of the family rests on a presumption that parents possess what a child lacks in maturity, experience, and capacity for judgment required for making life's difficult decisions. And that, in large part, still remains the predominant view. But for a long time, there have been exceptions to the rule that requires parents to authorize treatment for a minor. For example, most states have an exception to parental consent when the child has a true psychiatric emergency. Similarly, most states have an exception to parental consent when a minor is, quote, emancipated by marriage or by other circumstances, and so can legally make decisions for themselves. Beyond these two exceptions, some states have adopted what is called the mature minor rule. The mature minor rule holds that a minor who has sufficient maturity and intelligence to understand the nature and consequence of a therapy can legally consent to that therapy without parental consent. Often there's a minimum age at which the mature minor rule kicks in. This age can vary from 12 to 16. Under the mature minor rule, it's up to the healthcare provider, meaning you, to assess the minor's capacity to make a mature and intelligent decision about participating in the therapy. It's important to know that this assessment of adequate maturity in the minor can be a difficult process for a therapist, and it must be carefully documented. Fortunately, many states that have the mature minor rule also give the provider immunity from civil or criminal action if they act in good faith in making a determination about the minor's maturity to consent. Be aware, however, that some states don't have immunity, which creates a risk for the provider who is applying the mature minor rule. For this and many other reasons, it's critical that you know your own state's laws regarding parental and minor-based authorization to treatment. Finally, some states have simply set an age at which a minor can consent to outpatient psychotherapy, either for an unlimited period of time or for a set number of sessions, after which parental consent is then required. In states that either follow the mature minor rule or have a set age at which minors can't consent, the law typically gives healthcare providers the option of notifying parents that their minor child is seeking or receiving therapy, but parental notification is not usually required. The key here is that whenever you decide to treat a minor based solely on that minor's consent, it would be wise to document your assessment of the minor's decisional capacity, and where you have the option to notify the parents, you should document your reasons for either doing so or not doing so. Now, be aware that there is some risk to treating a minor without parental consent or notification. One risk is that the criteria for minor's consent is complicated, and it often requires skilled judgment and very careful documentation on your part. A second risk is that when minors consent to their own therapy, the parent is usually not required to pay for the therapy. And of course, most children cannot afford to pay for their treatment. So there's a financial risk to you in treating minors based solely on their own consent. A third risk is that even when minors can legally consent to therapy and you follow all of the required procedures, the parent of the minor may still be angry and retaliate against you in some way or make it impossible for the child to get to appointments. It's also important to know that when a minor can authorize their own treatment, they will also usually be able to control any disclosure of their treatment records, even to their parents. What I've said so far applies to outpatient psychotherapy. Be aware, however, that there are usually different rules for other types of therapy. The key here is to know your state's law regarding minors' ability to consent to treatment. Now, when a divorced or separated parent presents their child for outpatient treatment, another important issue to clarify is what type of treatment is being sought and who will be the patient. Although many separated or divorced parents bring their child to outpatient therapy to get the child needed help, sometimes parents may actually be seeking something different than individual treatment for the child. For example, they may really want reunification therapy, co-parenting therapy, or dyadic therapy to work out an issue between themselves and the child. It's critically important that the therapist establish at the outset precisely who is the patient and what type of therapy is being provided. Knowing exactly who the patient is matters because there's a profound difference between persons who are patients and those who are collaterals. When you're dealing with a patient, there must be informed consent, legal authorization to treat, clinical documentation of the work, and a variety of other licensing board imposed duties. Collaterals, however, usually have none of these rights, and you don't have many duties toward them. In addition, patients have what is called privilege, which is the ability to keep communications made to you, a licensed mental health provider, out of court, and patients are also owed a duty of confidentiality. Collaterals, however, are not entitled to either of these. So when you begin treating the child of separated or divorced parents, all participants should know whether they are collaterals or whether they are patients. When this is not clear, parents may believe that they are a patient when they are actually a collateral, and the parent is then surprised and angered to discover that their communications to you are not confidential and can be accessed by the other parent and can be used in court. The key here is to make sure that all participants are clear on the nature of therapy, whether it's individual for the child, dyadic therapy between a parent and a child, or family therapy. Participants must also be clear on precisely who is a patient and who is not. Finally, it's essential to explain to all participants how the patient versus collateral distinction affects their confidentiality, right of record access, and privilege. Another reason to be very clear about the type of therapy you're providing and about who is a patient and who is not is our ethical concern about functioning in dual roles. The ethics code does not prohibit dual relationships per se, but it does prohibit them when the dual relationship would impair any of the treatment relationships. Dual relationships can easily confuse and impair both the therapist and the patient. Unfortunately, it's very easy in treating a child to find yourself being asked to simultaneously engage in other treatment roles, such as providing parent training, couples therapy, or even individual therapy with one or both parents. The key here is to be very careful about engaging in multiple treatment relationships with members of the same family. For example, treating a parent in individual therapy and also treating their child in a separate individual therapy. Doing so puts the therapist in serious jeopardy. Okay, let's move on to the practical aspects of beginning a psychotherapy with a child of divorced or separated parents. Here we're assuming two things. The child is being seen in individual outpatient treatment, and two, that the minor is not authorizing their own treatment, but instead one of the child's parents is authorizing the treatment. Now, the first step here is to ask the presenting parent for a copy of the most recent custody decree and any subsequent court orders that pertain to custody of the child. You want to see the provisions in the decree that specify who has legal custody. Is it one parent, both parents, or neither parent? Note that physical custody of the child is usually not relevant for authorization purposes. If you're having trouble deciphering or understanding the parent's custody decree or any related legal documents, here's where it would be wise to consult with your own attorney. Now, it's important to know that in almost all states, if the presenting parent has legal custody, which can either be sole or joint, that parent can authorize treatment of the child. But you as the therapist, however, are always free to set your standard higher than the legal minimum, and you can require that both parents authorize the child's treatment. Doing so may discourage some parents from pursuing the therapy, but it will also minimize your risk. Even when the presenting parent claims to have legal custody or produces documentation that seems to show that they do, it's possible that a legal situation has changed since the issuance of the documentation. And it's also possible that the presenting parent may, intentionally or not, be misrepresenting the facts, which leads us to the next step. The therapist should, under most circumstances, insist on notifying the non-presenting parent that their child has been brought for treatment. Notifying the non-presenting parent serves several purposes. First, it allows the non-presenting parent to challenge the presenting parent's claims about who has legal custody. Second, even when the presenting parent does indeed have legal custody and can properly authorize the child's treatment on their own, notifying the other parent shows respect for that other parent and prevents the perception that the therapist is somehow aligned with the presenting parent against the other parent. Think about how you would feel if your parent was brought, if your child was brought to therapy without your knowledge. Third, notifying the non-presenting parent that their child has been brought to you allows the other parent to provide you with information that may give a more objective and complete picture of the child and thus lead to a better therapy. Now, sometimes in the course of gathering the custody documentation and talking to the parents, it will become clear that neither parent is the legal guardian of the child. In these cases, the court may have transferred custody to another family member, such as a grandparent, or the parents may have surrendered or lost custody. It's also possible that the child has been placed in the custody of the state. If this is the case, neither parent can authorize the child's therapy, and you must obtain authorization from the non-parent legal guardian. When this happens, you should request documentation from that non-parent legal guardian that shows that they indeed have the legal right to consent. It's risky to proceed without that documentation. Now, we believe it's best for a therapist to first meet with the parents individually on one or more occasions before meeting the child. In these preliminary meetings, you should notify the parent about your policy regarding whether their individual communications with you are confidential. In other words, will one parent's individual communications with you be available to the other parent? Some parents blurt out all kinds of negative things about the other and then are shocked to find out that the notes about their comments are in the child's chart and are available to everyone who can access the chart. The simplest and safest policy is to tell both parents that anything and everything they tell you in individual meetings, emails, or texts may be documented in the child's chart, and that anyone who can access the child's chart will also be able to see the record of that parent's individual communications with you. This prevents unpleasant and complicated surprises later. Next, it's important to work out how the parent will pay for the child's therapy. This often becomes a contentious issue because between separated or divorced parents, and they may dispute who is to pay and how much. My advice is to establish at the beginning that you expect full payment at each session and that the parents must work out any adjustments between themselves on their own. This can save you a lot of grief. Finally, you should establish a policy about how and when information about the child's treatment will be shared with the parents. I'll say more about this later, but for now, The important point is to treat the parents equally and neutrally in how and when you share the child's treatment information with them, and to not allow them to develop the impression that you're favoring one over the other. Now, this is the trust psychotherapy-informed consent for adults with an addendum for minor patients. You can find it on our website at trustinsurance.com. Before getting into the specifics of the informed consent, let me talk a little bit about some general procedures in starting therapy with a minor child. First, we suggest that you provide the informed consent document to the parents well in advance of any meetings so that they can read it at their own pace and formulate any questions they have when they meet you. With separated or divorced parents who cannot meet together, we suggest that you meet with each individually prior to meeting with a child. What you're trying to do in these parent meetings includes finding out whether the parents are, number one, in agreement with having the child in therapy, number two, whether they're in agreement with the terms of your informed consent, and three, whether they're in agreement on what the goals of the therapy will be. If there are any major differences between the parents on any of these issues, it's important that you address them immediately before beginning the treatment. Those parent meetings also give you an opportunity for you to decide, based on the parents' responses, whether you feel that you're willing and able to work with these parents and the child. For example, if a parent refuses to agree to give a teenage patient a zone of privacy, meaning that they won't agree that you will not report the child's every statement to them, you may decide that you're not the appropriate provider, and you would then refer them to another provider and discontinue the intake process. Also, part of the intake process should include asking parents a set of questions to help you identify the potential risk they pose to you or the therapy. These questions would include asking about the existence of any past, current, or planned litigation between the parents, as well as the parents' overall history of litigating or complaining against healthcare providers and professionals who have been involved with their child. The question should also include asking about any prior psychotherapy that the child has received and the parents' perceptions of the successes and failures of those past treatments. Basically, you're looking to gauge the likelihood that these parents will respond to the inevitable difficulties and challenges in the child's therapy by lashing out against you or against the treatment, and their past history will give you some idea about that. You should not feel compelled to take on a case that you are not comfortable with at the outset. The best time to end what appears likely to become a very problematic treatment is right at the beginning. So, to briefly summarize, in initiating treatment with the child of separated or divorced parents, number one, you want to verify who has legal custody. Number two, you want to obtain authorization from the parent or parents that does have legal custody. And three, you want to make sure both parents are aware that you are treating their child. Next, we suggest telling the parents that if at any point either parent decides that the child's treatment should end, you will honor that decision and end the therapy. Now, why have that policy? Well, because even though you can continue the child's therapy based just on one parent's authorization, it's generally unwise to continue a treatment when one parent is strongly opposed to continuing it. We have found that doing so, proceeding over one parent's strong objection, greatly increases the likelihood of a complaint, a negative review, or other negative action against you, the therapist. It's also difficult to do effective therapy when one parent is strongly opposed to it and may undermine any potential progress. Finally, it's wise to explain that if you do meet with the parents or any of the child's family members, you will make notes of those meetings and put those notes in the child's file. And those notes will be available to anyone that has legal access to the chart. The idea here is to caution parents and other collaterals about making statements that will come back to haunt them later. The next topic in the informed consent process concerns mandatory disclosures of treatment information. In this part of the informed consent, you notify the parents and the minor that there are some situations in which you must disclose treatment information to others, whether or not you have the parents or the child's consent. These situations include mandated child abuse reports and, in many states, Tarasoff type situations. So, for example, the child tells you that they plan to cause serious harm or death to someone else, and you believe they have the intent to do so. In your informed consent, you tell the child and the parents that if this occurs, you must notify the parents and potentially the intended victim and the police. Now, in other situations, you may have some discretion about whether to maintain the minor's confidentiality or choose to disclose the information to the parent without the child's consent. For example, the child may reveal to you that they're doing things that might cause serious harm to them or someone else, even though they're not intending to cause harm. These types of situations might include a child engaging in unsafe sexual activities, using dangerous drugs, or involving themselves in criminal activity. In these situations, you will need to use your professional judgment to decide whether you must inform the child's parents. Ultimately, it's a balancing test. On the one hand, preventing potentially serious harm befalling the child and respecting the parents' right to know about important situations in their child's life, while on the other hand, trying to maintain the child's trust in you so that the therapy can productively continue. Three factors can help you decide about whether to disclose these types of potentially risky behaviors to the parents. Number one, consider what you, the parents, and the child agreed to at the outset about what type of risky behavior you will disclose to the parents. Number two, consider what a reasonable parent would expect and want to know about their child's risky behaviors. And number three, consider whether there are any factors present that would make the situation seriously worse if you were to disclose the child's risky behavior to the parents. For example, a child may tell you that if the parent finds out about the child's sexual orientation, they will beat the child or kick the child out of the house. Generally, we recommend that you inform parents that even if the child engages in behaviors that the parent might not approve of or might even be upset by, you still will not tell them about these behaviors if the behaviors do not put the child at risk of serious and immediate harm. We've also found that giving specific examples of when you will and when you won't tell parents about a child's risky behavior is very helpful. For example, you may inform the parents that if the child reveals that he or she has tried alcohol at a few parties, you will not tell the parents. But on the other hand, if the child tells you that he or she is drinking and driving, or is a passenger in a car with a drunk driver, you will tell the parents. Another example, if the child reveals that he or she is having voluntary protected sex with the same age peer, you will not tell the parents. But if the child tells you that on several occasions they've engaged in unprotected sex with strangers or in unsafe ways, you will tell the parents. The keys here are to make sure that you, the parents, and the child have a reasonably accurate idea of what you will and won't disclose to the parents. And the more mutual understanding and agreement on this issue, the less likelihood for problems for the therapy and for you. Finally, you should carefully document your reasoning about why you are choosing to disclose or not disclose risky behaviors to the parents. The next issue we address in our informed consent process concerns situations where one or both parents wants to use the child's therapy information or records in custody litigation. You want to achieve a few different things in this part of the informed consent. You want to clarify that your role is as the child's therapist and is not to get involved in any custody, visitation, or other litigation. In our informed consent, we write, quote, "My role will be strictly limited to providing treatment to your child. You agree that in any child custody visitation proceeding, neither of you will subpoena my records or ask me to testify in court, or to provide letters or documentation expressing my opinion about parental fitness or custody," close quote. It's very important that you clarify this at the outset because not all parents understand the difference between a therapist role and a forensic evaluator role. You might ask, why take this position of not giving any opinion? The answer is that there are ethical and regulatory prohibitions against treating therapists giving opinions about custody or visitation. Essentially, doing so would be to engage in a dual role that would likely contaminate and undermine the therapy. In addition, giving such opinions would violate our ethical and regulatory prohibition about offering opinions about persons and issues that we have not formally evaluated. Remember that the child is your patient, and you typically have not evaluated or treated the parents, and thus should not be giving opinions about them. Now, it's important to understand that this, quote, agreement in the informed consent for the parents to not involve you in custody litigation is generally not legally enforceable, but it does carry some moral and persuasive authority in dissuading parents from doing so. Ultimately, however, if you're legally compelled to turn over the child's records or to testify at a deposition or trial, you must do so. Now, I included this slide because it shows, and this is part of our informed consent, that we encourage you to have the child also sign the document. This emphasizes the need to involve the minor patient in the informed consent process once they can reasonably comprehend the concepts of psychotherapy and confidentiality. And it helps the child see that they're active participants and not merely passive recipients in the therapy. Now, in many but not all states, parents ultimately have the legal right to obtain a copy of their child's treatment records. And importantly, this usually applies even to non-custodial parents, that is, parents who do not have legal custody. They too are usually able to obtain a copy of the record. In other words, regardless of whether a parent has legal custody, both parents usually have the right to obtain copies of the chart. This is another reason why it's important to try to involve both parents in the therapy at the outset. Now, despite this legal right, we suggest that you include in your informed consent a provision wherein the parents agree not to request access to the child's treatment file. Once again, the purpose is to protect the child's zone of privacy. Now, it's important to know that this agreement is most likely not legally enforceable, but again, it still has moral and persuasive authority. It can discourage parents from trying to access the child's entire treatment record. Such access is likely to completely undermine the child's trust in this and in any future therapies. There are times, however, when you can legally limit the nature and extent of the information you must disclose to the parents about the child's therapy. This usually occurs when you have a reasonable basis to believe that disclosing treatment information to the parents will seriously endanger the child or others. Now, in almost all states, when a healthcare provider determines that parental access to the child's treatment records would have a detrimental effect on the provider's professional relationship with the child, or that it would endanger the minor's physical safety or psychological well-being, you as the provider can legally limit the disclosure of the requested records to the parent. In denying or limiting parental access under these circumstances, you should document the specific reason for refusing to permit the parent to access this portion of the child's record. And you should specifically describe the likely detrimental consequences if this material were disclosed to the parent. When you decide to limit or withhold parental access to the child's file, the parent will usually have the legal right to challenge your decision. Typically, the parent can appeal your decision to limit disclosure, and there's usually a procedure in the law wherein you turn the child's records over to a third-party mental health professional or a committee who will either confirm your decision to withhold or not. But remember that withholding some or all of the treatment records from a parent is a major decision, and doing so should be done very carefully. It should be well justified, and the rationale for the decision should be carefully documented in the record. Before matters reach that point, we advise trying to negotiate a compromise with the parents, such as providing a general treatment summary or offering to have a discussion about the child's therapy instead of releasing the entire chart. On this slide, I briefly review strategies to limit risks to you in the therapy when treating children of separated or divorced parents. Here are some of the strategies. Be on the lookout for hidden parental agendas for the child's therapy and address them when they emerge. Also, make sure the parents understand your role as a treating therapist and not a forensic evaluator, and periodically remind them of this. Involving both parents. As much as possible to include both parents. You can't force a parent to be involved, but try to provide periodic updates that are sufficiently general to protect the intimate details of the child's treatment, but also give the parents some useful information about their kid. Number three, the elusive goal of neutrality. Pay attention to complaints from a parent who feels that you are not treating them fairly or are favoring the other parent. Take these complaints very seriously and address them immediately. Number four, limit setting. Some separated or divorced parents are highly anxious and will flood the therapist with emails, phone calls, and texts about the child, about themselves, and about the other parent. Sometimes the parent is also trying to create a record to use against the other. If this happens, one approach is to set limits on the frequency and type of communication between you and the parent. You may decide, for example, that a biweekly or monthly clinical update is enough. You may also want to limit the ways that parents can communicate with you. For example, the use of text and emails by parents creates the expectation of an immediate response from you, which is often impossible. One option is to not allow the use of text or email or to limit their frequency. It's also important that parents understand that if they raise urgent issues in texts or emails to you, there may be a significant delay before you have a chance to see it, and that they should instead telephone you about any urgent matters. Number 5, dealing with GALs. In some states, when there is active custody litigation that involves a minor patient, the court may appoint an attorney or a guardian ad litem, who can be an attorney or another professional, to represent the child's best interests or wishes in the custody case. If you receive contact from the child's attorney or GAL, the first thing to do is to ask that person to provide documentation that shows what authorities and powers the court has given the attorney or GAL with regard to the child's therapy. Again, if you have trouble understanding the document, it's best to consult with your own attorney. Now, sometimes the attorney or GAL can access the child's treatment record without parental permission, and sometimes not. It's important to know this before you start discussing the case with the GAL. Number 6, licensing board perspectives. A substantial number of board complaints arise against therapists who are treating children of separated or divorced parents. These complaints can occur because the therapist refuses to go along with a parent's demand that the therapist become an advocate for that parent, or because the therapist withholds sensitive information from the parent, or because the parent believes the therapist is conspiring with the other parent against them. Generally, boards are more skeptical and have a higher level of scrutiny for complaints that arise in the context of high conflict families and custody disputes, but they will still consider and review the complaint. Be aware that there is a much higher than usual risk that your notes may be reviewed by third parties, including licensing boards, when you treat children of separated or divorced parents. Furthermore, your records may end up in court. For this reason, it is wise to write your notes as though both of the children's parents and the licensing board and the judge may eventually read them. Keeping this in mind will help you keep your notes entirely professional and avoid including material that will spark problems later. It's important to remember that in these high conflict families, the parents frequently go to war against each other and may seek to pull you into their battle. Your best response is to maintain your boundaries, gently but firmly set limits, and devote your attention to treating the child. But if the conflict between the parents becomes too acrimonious and you conclude that you can no longer effectively treat the child, it is always acceptable and even ethically mandated to make changes, which can include terminating the case. Now, continuing the topic of disclosing minors' treatment information, it's important to be aware that in some states, once the minor reaches a particular age, the minor has exclusive control over disclosure of information to others, even their parents. In Washington State, for example, a minor patient who is 13 automatically controls disclosure of their treatment information, even to their parents. Similarly, in Illinois, a minor patient who is 12 years old or older also controls disclosure of most of their treatment information, even to their parents. As always, know and be familiar with your state laws on record access. Now, if your state law or HIPAA does not permit you to limit parental access to the child's treatment information, it's prudent to give the parents equal access to the records or a summary if they're willing to accept that. We also suggest that you inform both parents when either one makes a request for the child's record. This helps to avoid a situation where one parent is surprised that the other parent has information that they do not, or mistakenly believes that you're favoring one over the other. Now I want to emphasize that it's important to try to stay out of disputes between the parents. If you believe that the parent's personal issues are seriously interfering with the treatment, consider referring the parents to their own individual therapy. If you believe that the parent's conflicts with each other are seriously interfering with the child's treatment, consider referring them to co-parenting therapy. If the parents turn out to be seeking a forensic custody opinion from you, refer them to their attorneys, and suggest that they seek a neutral forensic evaluator. If the parents ask you questions that concern custody, visitation, orders of protection, or other legal matters, refer them to their own attorneys. Do not give legal advice to parents. Most importantly, do not become an advocate for either parent's views or positions, and instead continually focus on helping the child deal with their problems. It's important to mention that HIPAA's role regarding both parental authorization and parental right of access to the child's therapy record. HIPAA generally defers to state law when it comes to minors, and most of the relevant law will be in your state statutes. But there are a few exceptions where HIPAA trumps state law, the most important of which is the following. Under HIPAA, a provider may choose to treat a parent as not the legal guardian of a child if the provider has a reasonable belief that either A, the child has been or may be subjected to domestic abuse, violence, or neglect by that parent, or the provider reasonably believes that treating the parent as the legal guardian would endanger the child. If either of these situations apply, you in the exercise of your professional judgment can decide that it's not in the best interest of the child to treat that parent as the child's legal guardian. Under these circumstances, you can refuse to allow that parent to consent to the child's treatment, and you can limit that parent's right of access to the records. Now, this HIPAA rule trumps every state law and allows you to treat a parent, even one who has legal guardianship of the child, as not having parental rights if these conditions are met. This is not a decision, however, to make lightly, and it's important that the provider carefully document the domestic violence, abuse, or neglect to which the child has been subjected, or to document why treating the parent as the guardian would endanger the child. Sometimes, despite your best efforts to keep the child's therapy out of the parents' litigation against each other, you may still be required to submit the child's treatment records or provide testimony in the custody litigation. The demand for your involvement in the litigation typically occurs when one or both parents subpoena the child's treatment record or your testimony. A subpoena is a demand by an attorney for records or testimony. What follows next are some things to know when a demand is made on you by subpoena. By itself, a subpoena is usually not sufficient to require you to produce records or to testify. In addition to the subpoena, the child's privilege must be waived by someone who has the legal authority to do so. Usually, this is a parent who has sole or joint legal custody, but in some states and in some situations, there may be an attorney for the child who may be the only one empowered to waive the child's privilege. I think I'm going to stop there. We have a little bit more slides. But I want to make sure we leave time for questions.
Well, thank you very much for that presentation, Dr. Scopo. It was really, really interesting and obviously highly complex and involved issues at hand. And I'm very grateful to you for stopping where you did, because we have had just a real torrent of very interesting questions. I'm going to try and do my best justice to all of these in the limited time we have remaining. Many of our questions, Joe, have to do with transitions in custody either during or after therapy has taken place. For example, if parents are in the process of divorce but have not yet obtained a divorce, so there are no legal decrees in place, what happens, who determines treatment then? And then what happens later on if one parent, for example, is granted custody and the other is not? Do you then go back and provide the non-custodial parent with records for what happened during the treatment?
Well, I should first say that often when parents begin a divorce process, there can often be a temporary order of custody, and there often is. So it's not necessary that the divorce be completed before there's some legal adjudication or some basic stipulation or agreement between the parents regarding custody. And that documentation would be sufficient and helpful to the therapist.
So you look for a temporary order of custody.
Correct, or a stipulation, or meaning an agreement between the parents that will be in effect temporarily as they continue through the divorce process. you can rely on that documentation. With regards to the question of what would happen if custody changes during the course of treatment, the key thing is to make sure you have on record an authorization from at least one parent who has legal guardianship. And if that has changed, then you're going to need to get informed consent from the newly empowered parent in order to continue. But as I said before, in most states, in almost all states, even non-custodial parents have a right of access to the child's treatment record. So regardless of custody, usually both parents can get the record. And that's one important reason to try to involve both of them in the treatment, so that one doesn't suddenly request the chart and find out all this information that they didn't know about, which produces anger, which produces problems.
So the safest thing is to presume that all parents will at some point have the ability to access those records, regardless of their current or future legal standing vis-a-vis the child.
Correct. Most states don't allow both parents. Unless there's a court prohibition, both parents, you should assume both parents can obtain the records.
That seems like a very good common sense ground rule to follow. But what happens, for example, in the case of a court-appointed individual like a guardian ad litem? Are there limits to the type of records that GAL may access, or do they have carte blanche to look into the child's treatment records?
The answer to that question lies in requesting the order that appointed the GAL or the attorney for the child. The court appoints these persons, and in the appointment order, there would be a specification of what powers and authorities the GAL or the child's attorney has. So you would ask for the GAL or the attorney to give you a copy of that appointing order, and you read it, and it will tell you what rights the GAL or the attorney has and what they don't. So that's where you'll get your answer as to whether they can access the treatment record in an unfettered way, or if there are limitations on them doing so.
So if the GAL were to request records, you would request a copy of the order appointing the GAL to see if there were any restrictions contained there.
Exactly. That's correct.
Right, great. Here's another interesting question. I mean, just people have provided some really, really meaty questions here. Some states have mature minor laws of consent that allow the child to make independent decisions about therapy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. How does that apply to their preference for parental involvement in treatment?
So
if you're a minor, can you say, Dad, I don't want you in this therapy? And if so, does Dad have any rights subsequently to obtain those therapeutic records?
The general rule is that if the treatment is based on minor consent, in other words, if the minor initiates the treatment and is the one who authorizes it, generally that minor will entirely control disclosure of the records and the involvement of parents in the treatment. This may seem somewhat counterintuitive, and in some ways it is. As I said, in Washington at 13, a minor fully controls disclosure of their records. And some folks have the opinion that at 13, that may not be the best age for a parent, for a child to be able to decide what the parents can see or not. Nevertheless, that is the rule, and the child effectively controls any disclosure of information in when they consent on their own to anybody. So it can create some weird and unusual situations, but where that's the law, the therapist must honor that provision.
So basically, you have to look very carefully at your state regs and determine when emancipated minors are allowed to make decisions about their ability to engage in treatment. Or
yes, not emancipated. Emancipated is just one way that a minor can acquire the right to consent.
Okay.
There are a variety of ways. Ideally, a therapist should know all the different ways that a minor can be empowered to authorize for themselves.
Here's another very interesting question, similar to the last one. What about if a child is, say, away at a boarding school and the parents live in another state, in which jurisdiction and do the laws apply? In the state where the parents are seeking a divorce, or in the state where the child is at school?
Oh, that's a good question. Very good question. The laws that apply almost always are the laws in effect where the therapy is taking place. And if the divorce action or custody action is occurring in another state, the laws of where the therapy is occurring is what controls. And this can create complications because the court in the other state does not have any legal jurisdiction over you, the therapist, in the different state. And this can lead to some difficulties. In that kind of situation, I would suggest consulting with us if you're a trust insured, or consulting with another professional, because it can get difficult to figure out what authority the court does have in that other state over you in a different state.
Interesting. So, again, I'm dealing with some other issues pertaining to custody. A listener asks, are there differences between the types of custody that a parent receives? Are there any differences, for instance, between someone who has physical custody of a child and someone who has custody over the legal affairs of the child, or do you just not see that as a situation that might occur?
Yes, that's a good question. It's confusing to non-lawyers to distinguish between legal custody and physical custody. Legal custody is what you as a therapist are primarily interested in, because it's the power to make decisions for the child. Physical custody refers simply to where the child resides at different times and with which parent. But physical custody itself doesn't tell you anything about the decision-making authority of the parent. So it's best to look at the custody decree and look at the legal decision-making. And sometimes, you know, one parent or both parents will have legal custody, but sometimes the court will divide up decision making between the parents so that, for example, one parent has decision making for health care and the other parent has decision making for educational decisions. This is increasingly a trend now in custody determinations. So what you would look for is which parent is empowered to make health care decisions and thus be able to authorize the treatment.
I see. Well, thank you very, very much for this presentation on an extremely complex topic. And I have certainly learned a lot, and I hope that our other listeners have as well. My final question, which I hope is going to be an easy one to answer, but many, many listeners are requesting a copy of the informed consent document that you use. I presume that is the document that might be available to trust policyholders, or is there another way that they can access that?
Well, actually, it's available to everybody. You don't have to be a trust insured. You can go on trustinsurance.com and look under the resources tab and then the document library, and then look for the template therapy-informed consent with minor addendum. And I should also note that in that same area, you will find something called a collateral-informed consent. And it's a one-page document, and it's very handy to keep in your office. As soon as somebody who's not a patient is brought in, could be a parent, could be a sibling, could be another family member, you pull out your collateral consent form and you hand it to the collateral. And on the form, it clearly explains what their rights or the lack of rights that applies to them. And this is very useful because it prevents confusion later on down the road as to what status that person was in when they came to talk with you. And you'll find other documents as well in that same area. They're available to anyone who. You don't have to be a trust insured to use them.
I see. Well, thank you for that. But I would point out one thing, as I frequently remind folks who call into our office with questions, you know, the trust does provide gratis legal consultation on these very difficult issues. So I would encourage folks, even if those documents are freely available to non-trust holders, but if you are a trust holder and you run across one of these situations, I do believe it would be in your best interest to get this kind of consultation to help you wend your way through these sometimes highly complex and very emotionally charged situations.